second hour of the Bible study. Traditionally, usually known as Ask the Pastor. However, today it will be Ask the Packer. Fan. Which is, in terms of etymology, close. But no cigar. With us is Pastor Kurt Taylor. He is pastor up in Waltz, Michigan. St. John's, is it?
That's it, Chuck.
St. John's, Waltz, Michigan. Where the waltzing, at least in the pastor's office, has been significant. Do you not have a full-size cutout of Brett Favre in your office?
I do, and he's currently wearing a cheese head.
You're not throwing darts at him, are you?
No. I was getting close to taking it home, but, you know, I was hoping they would come up with some resolution that would make all of us happy. I don't know if there's going to be, but he's still our quarterback, Chuck.
Well, I don't want to get too far afield here into the world of sports, although I know you and I could probably stay there for a while. But my biblical question to you as it pertains to your very favorite football team in the world, maybe your favorite team of all, what happened to let your yes be yes and your no be no?
Well,
let your retirement be retirement and your retirement stay retirement.
I know.
I may paraphrase.
I know, and that's what upsets many of us. It was a perfect way to go out, stirred things up to come back. But, you know, after all is said and done, he's the best quarterback for the job, and that's where I'd have him.
But you're not happy with him.
Well, no, I'm not.
Well, now, make up your mind.
Well, it's one of these things where you just kind of keep your mouth shut because you don't want to be seen as an enabler, right? You're the kind of person that's just gonna stay quiet, let it work out. But deep inside, I'm really hoping that he's the starting quarterback for the opening game.
Have you you have a wife, don't you, Pastor Taylor?
Indeed.
Does she ever, from time to time, probably not very often, but does she ever change her mind?
Yes, yes.
Is it a sin to change your mind, Pastor Taylor?
I don't think it's a sin to change your mind.
Well,
in fact, to the definition of the word repent is to change one's mind. So we're called to do that.
So Brett Favre, the beloved Brett Favre,
has repented.
Who has reached certainly iconic status with most Packer fans, will live in their minds and hearts forever as probably Green Bay's greatest quarterback, Bart Starr notwithstanding.
Exactly.
He can change his mind, can't he?
He can change his mind.
That's not a sin.
No.
Then why are you mad at him?
Well, because it was so perfect, the way he went out. Yeah, the emotional farewell, the kind of the official turning over of the team to the promising young Aaron Rodgers, the way that he was so real and in front of all of us, and how he ended his career after the NFC Championship game, that just seems so perfect. That's the way you want your heroes to go out, with that kind of glory. And who knows what it's going to be like. Now, they may come back, and they may go to the Super Bowl this year, in which case that would be an even more glorious way to go out. But that's why I'm kind of upset.
Well, there is another reason to be upset, and I'm not, you know, I really like the Packers. I'm not a Packer fan like you. I don't have a full-size cutout of Brett Favre in my office or radio studio here, but he has done some damage in the sense that the team, and it really is all about the team, isn't it? It really is all about the congregation, isn't it, Pastor? The team honored his wishes, waved him goodbye, and began probably no small amount of planning to get ready for the upcoming football season with Aaron Rodgers at the helm and all of the strategic, tactical, and even emotional and personal things that that implies.
Yes.
Well, he just upset that apple cart, and while it may be unfortunate that his kind of fairy tale retirement and all the loveliness of it has been trashed, well, there are some other consequences here that are negative. Is he responsible for those?
If, in fact, it really is all about the team, and the team is all about winning, then wouldn't you want your best chance of winning as your quarterback? And that's the way some of us have come down on this. Even though we're not happy about how this has all played out, I think he made some serious miscalculations. I think he thought that he'd be welcomed back with open arms, no questions asked. But at the end of the day, when all the chips are down, don't you want the best quarterback you can have to give your team the best chance of winning? And that, it seems to me, is Brett Favre.
Well, that is spoken like a true Packer fan. I'm not so sure that the theology of it is all that sound, but
that's football.
What would I know? What would I know? Well, you know, and the thing that has to have you holding your breath is that if he doesn't play well in the first 4 weeks, you're going to have a mess on your hands, you
yep.
Green Bay fans.
Oh, absolutely.
You're going to have a mess on your hands that may disrupt the whole thing.
It could. Yeah, that's right. We've entered into this era now where who knows what's going to happen from week to week. And once again, I blame him for that, but that's what we've got.
It is what it is.
It is what it is.
As some prominent, intelligent person once said. Well, you know, I wondered why they didn't just welcome him back, tell him he's the backup. Aaron Rodgers has been given the job because he retired, and all that planning has gone forward. Aaron Rodgers is the quarterback. Brett will be the backup. If Aaron Rodgers stumbles, well, then you don't have a mess. Then Brett can slide back into the job. Not because it was handed to him, but because Aaron Rodgers stumbled. And then it seems you avoid all that stuff.
Well, here's the problem, though. What constitutes stumbling? Because there are so many people that are absolutely behind Brett Favre that the first time young Aaron Rodgers throws an interception, you're going to have half the stadium calling for Brett to come in, or the first game that's lost, you're going to have mayhem. You're going to have everybody calling on, you know, Brett to come back, and I think it would be worse for Rodgers to start with Favre behind him than it would be for Favre to start with Rodgers behind him, because Aaron Rodgers has a lot more to lose if he starts, because if he starts and he falls flat, then Favre's back in and Rodgers is forgotten. If Favre starts and he wins, well, then it's the right decision. But if he falls flat, then it goes back to the plan that was originally there. Aaron Rodgers is your quarterback now.
Well, it is a controversy of near biblical proportions.
Did you know, Chuck, that your own St. Louis Rams are holding their spring or their fall training camp up at my alma mater?
I am fully aware of that.
Yeah, I think that's great.
And I don't know why we didn't, you know, pay you a couple of bucks to slip over there to your alma mater and file morning or everyday reports. You probably would have done that, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. No, Concordia University, Wisconsin, which has a beautiful football field. Well, it's not beautiful, but it's adequate. But a beautiful new dorm facility was built, and I don't know how it happened, but the Rams latched onto that, and it's right on the lake. I don't know if you've ever been there, Chuck.
I have not.
Our campus is right on the lake, and so whatever you see the temperature being in Milwaukee, it's 10 degrees cooler at least up at our campus.
So basically we should be there right now.
Oh, yeah. Comfortable.
All right, let's stop with all this frivolity and turn to something really serious.
All right.
Namely, aliens.
Oh.
Okay, here is an article that comes to us from The Sun, an otherwise nearly reputable news source, with the headline, Man Dubs Lake Tahoe Creature Caught on Camera a Leprechaun Alien. Here's the story. A Florida man vacationing at Lake Tahoe claims he caught a tiny, elf-like figure dubbed the Leprechaun Alien on film as the creature was fleeing a forest. The figure, who looks no taller than 3 feet, can be seen running from the trees just as 41-year-old Lloyd Deneau whipped out his camera to take a picture of the forest. Deneau swears the image has not been doctored. When I took the picture, I'm sure there was no one there, he said. It was only when I downloaded it on my camera that I saw it. I showed it to my friends and family, but no one can explain it. My kids coined it the leprechaun alien. He added, I have a military background and don't really believe in aliens, but I can't explain this. As well as an elf, leprechaun, and alien, the figure has been even been described as a baby Bigfoot. You know, I don't know why, if the creature is no taller than 3 feet, that it can't be a kid.
Yeah.
But apparently that's so obvious that it can't be a kid, because nobody seems to think that's the truth. Eventually, when the aliens hit the news, Christians start hearing, if not wondering, about assertions that, you know, there are other people in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
There are other creatures in the universe. God made a pretty big universe there, Pastor Taylor, and for us to think that we're the only ones, creatures of our intellectual stature, is quite an arrogant position to take. When those things pop up, what does Pastor Taylor say?
I've thought about this. I can't find anything in the Bible which suggests to me that there can't be life elsewhere. This question actually comes up every once in a while, and being kind of a science fiction fan myself, it's fun to think about how there might be life elsewhere. I think biblically we have to understand a couple of things, that if there is, God made it, because God is the one who created the heavens and the earth. He created the universe. So it's not as though there might be life out there that has escaped a God's detection or something, or is outside of God's control. If there is any life out there, it would be completely under God's control, because he made it. The other thing is that the Bible has to do with God's relationship with people in this world, this planet. As far as I know, I don't find any scripture reference to God's interaction with anybody else on any other planet but planet Earth. That doesn't necessarily mean that there can't be anyone else elsewhere. It's just that the Bible strictly sticks to God's relationship to us and what he's done to save us. And that being said, if somebody has anything scriptural that would either lend itself to saying there may be life out there or disproving it, I'd be real interested to know what it is, because I haven't seen it. And so I kind of go on the side of maybe there is, but like everything else, it's under God's control.
Well, here's another story, same theme, out of Lancaster, Texas, off the Christian Newswire. It says, is our society about to acknowledge the existence of aliens? A second credible member of the public has spoken out on the topic. Just last week, former NASA astronaut Edgar Mitchell, speaking on BBC Radio, said aliens exist and have been observing Earth for, quote, quite some time, unquote. The 77-year-old Mitchell, one of only 12 human beings to have walked on the moon, also said that events like the reported 1947 alien spaceship crash at Roswell, New Mexico, occurred and were hushed up by the U.S. and other governments for various reasons. In a May interview with Italian newspaper, and I can't pronounce it, the Vatican's chief astronomer, the Reverend Jose Gabriel Funes, said there is no conflict between believing in extraterrestrial intelligent life and believing in God. How can we exclude that life has developed elsewhere, Reverend Funes asked, even implying that some aliens might not have been subject to the separation from God described in Genesis. There could be other beings who remained in full friendship with their Creator. It's coming, Pastor Taylor.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody is going to want to get pastor's view on all of this alien stuff.
Sure. Well, it's happened before, too.
Well, maybe it has happened. I know it has happened before, but I'm not sure that the question, is our society about to acknowledge the existence of aliens, has been asked and answered.
Yeah, that's probably true. And the funny thing is, you know, when you were talking about that story, I Googled it up here, and I've got a picture, the picture that you were referring to. And isn't it fascinating how all pictures of aliens are really, really fuzzy, that you can't really make them out? if somebody were to ask me, what do you really think about this, I'd say it's probably a hoax. And that makes a lot more sense to me than an alien being in Lake Tahoe. I think the wider picture is...
Doubting Thomas.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know. But I think the wider picture is the one that you started, and that was, could there be? And again, I don't know that there's... I don't believe there's anything in the scripture that would preclude the possibility of life elsewhere. Again, as long as we understand that God is the God of the universe.
Well, and there you've drawn the bright line. Now, for some time, weeks, even months, if not years, we have been exposed through the media to this fascination on the part of scientists who seem, you know, this is the way it seems to me, who seem to think that if they find water on Mars, boom, it's over.
Yep.
Their life is not just contained to Earth. And evolution is true, and pastors and Bible study hosts are idiots, and the jury is in.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about, sort of that
yep.
dynamic.
Yep.
So now comes word today out of Los Angeles. NASA's Phoenix spacecraft, that's the one up there on Mars, busily searching for some kind of molecule of water which will confirm all of the evolutionary assertions. NASA's Phoenix spacecraft has detected the presence of a chemically reactive salt in the Martian soil, a finding that, if confirmed, could make it less friendly to potential life than once believed.
Interesting.
Scientists previously reported that the soil near Mars' North Pole was similar to backyard gardens on Earth, where plants such as asparagus, green beans, and turnips could grow. By the way, I'm reading this right off the Associated Press, even if there is some cynicism in my voice. But preliminary results from a second lab test found perchlorate, a highly oxidizing salt that would create a harsh environment. The first test suggested Earth-like soil. Further analysis has revealed un-Earth-like aspects of the soil chemistry, according to Chief Scientist Peter Smith of the University of Arizona in Tucson in a statement issued yesterday. On Earth, perchlorate is a natural and man-made contaminant sometimes found in soil and groundwater. It is the main ingredient in solid rocket fuel and can be found in fireworks, pyrotechnics, and other explosives. It's unclear how perchlorate forms on Mars or how much there is of it. NASA is investigating whether the substance could have gotten there by contamination before launch. Phoenix used another fuel, hydrazine, to power its thrusters and land on the red planet on May 25th. This is a setback.
Uh-huh. Well, one might ask the scientists, who's to say that life on Mars isn't completely and entirely different and made up of entirely different chemicals than life on Earth, too?
Well, you know, this is the thing that I always found fascinating, because if you truly believe in evolution, that sophisticated life can emerge and organize itself somehow,
mm-hmm.
then why can't it organize itself out of nitrogen instead
yeah.
of carbon or any of these other elements?
Yeah, exactly.
But we're always looking for life like us.
Yeah, because, and I think you said it right before, if there can be some, quote, evidence that life like us might exist somewhere else and they can find some sort of a link to evolution. That's what they're looking for. It's like you go into the whole thing with a theory in mind. You're out to prove a theory. I sometimes question. I don't mean to say anything negative about NASA, but I'll just say of some scientists in general. I question. We as Christians are always accused of having our own agenda. Of always allowing our own preconceived notions influence what we say, what we believe. And I believe the same thing is true for scientists. They have their own preconceived notions that this world as we live in today got here completely by accident. That's their operating principle. That's their worldview. And so that's what they're going to find when they're going out and doing all the exploration. they're not going to be able to help but find things that are going to somehow back up their preconceived notion. Now, you and I could sit here and we could take any bit of evidence that we see these scientists come up with, and I think we would just as easily be able to demonstrate the biblical accuracy of creation by whatever evidence they're going to come up with. So I think they would be just as guilty, and I might even add more so, of going in with an agenda and preconceived notions than even we are.
Well, that is a troubling assertion, and most people who have spent some time thinking about this question, when we arrive at that place, it's a very uncomfortable place. We would like to think that our scientists are faithful to the scientific method, the scientific method being a method which is designed to produce the truth of any experiment or any laboratory experiment. Without preconceived notions, do the experiment, analyze the results, draw your conclusions based on the facts. But if we're sending probes to Mars with the preconceived notion that evolution is true, and all we need to do is discover a water molecule and we win, then the scientific method has been corrupted. And I think that's a very disturbing thing.
It is disturbing, and it should be, especially because, really, if science is exalted as the discipline of the age, which I think it is, that nothing trumps science. Theology doesn't do it. Name your discipline. Nothing trumps science. Science has a vested interest in making sure that thoughts of or indications of God not be prominent. It has a vested interest in making sure that science remains the chief discipline and not theology. Otherwise, they begin to lose their status. They begin to lose their place in how people view who they should listen to, who they can trust. They have a vested interest that there be no God in the mix. And that is how this gets to be so troubling, because it seems as though so often when we find bits of evidence uncovered here and there, it's all going to be supporting the idea that the world or the universe is accidental and that there could be no God involved. It's only when occasionally you'll hear some things about intelligent design and things like that where we get even more evidence, but I just don't know that that makes it onto the front page as much as evidence contrary to that.
All right, well, let's see. Maybe our listeners have some thoughts on that. They want to call in at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Certainly welcome to do that as we have our conversation today with Pastor Kurt Taylor. On the other side of the break, I want to get your opinion or your thoughts on this story out of Memphis, Tennessee. Now, I think most of us like to think that the Bible gives us a pretty good indication on what's right and what's wrong. Remember that woman down there who murdered her husband?
Yeah.
She has her three kids back.
Yeah.
And I want to know from Pastor Taylor whether that's right or wrong. We'll be back. Stay with us here on our Bible study program.
We appreciate your comments and opinions here at AM 850 KFUO. We made it easy for you to contact us. Just go to Worldwide KFUO at KFUO.org and click on the contact button. It's on your left. That will take you to the contact page with all the contact information. You'll find our phone number, our mailing address, and email addresses for all the staff. Write us, call us, or email us today. We're Worldwide AM 850 KFUO.
There's no better time than summer to visit Lohmeyer Sculpture Park in Sunset Hills, the 105-acre outdoor art museum. Along with walking the dog, you can also bring the family and watch a movie or listen to a live band on selected summer nights. The park is open daily from 8 a.m. to sunset. It's free except for special exhibitions. Call 314-821-1209 or visit lohmeyer.org.
A snake's protective actions are evidence of God-given wisdom. Learn about it next on today's Creation Moments. And now, here's our Creation Moments host, Ian Taylor.
Some animals use quite a bag of tricks to make their living or protect themselves. The puff adder is one example of a wise serpent. The puff adder is harmless, and if you try to grab him, he will coil himself up so that you will have to reach past his head. Then he puffs up his head like a cobra. Well, no one wants to grab a cobra. And if you try again, he will realize that this plan isn't working, so he'll go to plan B. He'll strike at your leg, pretending to bite. But he won't bite. He just hopes you'll run off. If you persist, the puff adder goes to plan C, writhing on the ground as if he is in terrible pain. Finally, he turns over on his back, tongue hanging out of his mouth as if he were dead. Even if you pick him up and handle him, he will continue to pretend to be dead unless you put him back on the ground on his stomach. If you do that, he'll flip over and return to his original dead position. Jesus warned Christians not to be foolish, but rather to be wise like the serpent, yet harmless as doves. He has given the puff adder wisdom, but just think how much more wisdom he wants to give us, if only we will allow him.
For a free copy of our Creation Resource Catalog, visit our website at creationmoments.com. Or call us toll-free at 1-800-42-BIBLE. That's 1-800-422-4253. And be sure to join us next time for another Creation Moment, proclaiming evidence of God's truth.
The Christ-centered programs you hear every day on AM 850 KFUO are made possible by the generous giving of friends like Orville and Janice Hyden of Mason, Illinois, Gloria Heiletag of Barnhart, Missouri, the Reverend Chuck Herr of High Ridge, Missouri, and Ed and Lisa Holderly of St. Louis, Missouri. Your faithful support for AM 850 KFUO ensures the future of our radio ministry.
You know, the word free has a way of getting your attention. If you would like publicity for your event at no cost, send your information to us here at AM 850 KFUO. We'll include the details of your event on our date book. It airs three times daily, and it's free. Just send the information via email to dsummers@kfuo.org. D-S-U-M-M-E-R-S at kfuo.org.
What a crazy world we live in. As I recall, my parents used to say the same kind of thing. They had no idea. Our numbers are 505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727 if you'd like to share a question or a comment here on our Ask the Packer program. Here's a story, Pastor Kurt Taylor, out of Memphis, Tennessee. This will bring to mind events of some months ago, probably still fairly fresh in the minds of people. Mary Winkler, the woman convicted of voluntary manslaughter in the 2006 shooting death of her minister husband, has taken custody of her three daughters, according to one of her lawyers speaking yesterday. Rachel Putnam, a custody attorney, said the former minister's wife picked up the girls Friday from the slain man's parents, Dan and Diane Winkler. She is absolutely overjoyed, Putnam said. The lawyer said the children will live with Winkler at her home near McMinnville, about 60 miles southeast of Nashville. The 34-year-old Winkler was convicted of voluntary manslaughter last year for shooting her husband, 31-year-old Church of Christ minister Matthew Winkler, at their Selmer home in March 2006. Sentenced to 3 years in prison, she received probation for most of it, spending only 12 days in jail after her sentencing and 2 months in a mental health facility before being released. The children, ages 11, 9, and 3, had previously been living with their grandparents and had court-ordered visits with their mother. It should be seen as a sign of the family is healing, Putnam said of the custody arrangement. It's a good thing for everyone. Putnam said a court order giving Winkler custody has not been completed, but she said the custody case between the grandparents and Winkler will eventually be concluded. Now, call me whatever you want. Call me a Scrooge. Call me a creep. But it seems to me that if someone kills their 31-year-old husband, that probation and an otherwise return to a normal situation in the wake of that voluntary manslaughter is not consistent with my understanding of right and wrong. Now, how do you see it?
It's amazing that we would even have to be talking about something like this, because doesn't it just rub against every sensibility we have that if the mother kills the father and is convicted for doing that, she ought not be the one to raise the children? It's almost laughable, in my opinion, that we would even have to reiterate this. People might say, well, it's more healthy for the children to be with their natural mother instead of being raised by grandparents. Well, I don't know that that's true if the natural mother is a killer. And especially when, I believe one of the kids was 8 years old when this all happened. 8 years old, you've already developed a relationship with your father. You know who he is. You know what he's about. And now you're living with the person who killed him. There just seems like something incredibly wrong with this whole thing. The loving family that would have, in my opinion, raised these kids has now had these kids taken from them, and now they get to be raised by the person that killed their father.
And what would you say to somebody who says, that's none of your business? I mean, you live in Michigan. Chuck, you live in Illinois. This happened in Tennessee. They have their authorities. They have their court system. They worked it through, and this is where they have arrived. I don't know why you're even talking about it. You can't possibly know 10% of all of the facts that pertain to this case.
There's some truth to that, except I think we're also addressing something larger than this individual case, and that is whether a person should expect consequences for things that they do. Certainly in this society, people I believe are getting to are beginning to not think that there ought to be consequences for things that they do. In this society today, that there would be someone who lauds and applauds this sort of thing and says something like it should be seen as a sign that the family is healing and that it's a good thing for everyone. That strikes me as someone in a prominent leadership position who has no clue what a family is, what children need, and so I think we're even addressing something larger than this individual case, because we're talking about what's best for children, and that doesn't seem to be too complicated. What's best for children? To be raised by grandparents who love them, or a mother who has killed their father?
Now, as I recall from this case 2 years ago, at least as the media reported it, there was some evidence that this minister was a bit of an abuser.
Mm-hmm.
And that in spite of the fact that you might think, well, he's a pastor, so he's probably a great husband and a great father, well, that was reportedly not necessarily the case.
Mm-hmm.
And that it may have been true that Mary Winkler and the children were in danger of some physical violence or abuse. She was charged with voluntary manslaughter and convicted. So apparently that certainly suggests that self-defense was not involved. In other words, she didn't shoot him to protect herself. She did it voluntarily. Does the Bible have anything to say about this? Apparently the Tennessee authorities said this is voluntary manslaughter. I'm sort of the impression that the Bible would call this murder.
Yeah, I kind of think so. You know, I suppose, I mean, you mentioned self-defense, and interestingly, there was nothing that ever came up about abuse prior to this happening. It's not like she had ever called the police.
Well, she would have a huge incentive not to do that because her husband's a pastor.
Yeah.
If she says, you know, my husband beats me up, then she brings down his ministry and everything. I can see where she'd want to keep that quiet.
But if she is intending to demonstrate that she should be the best one qualified to raise those children, I wonder if that might not have been demonstrated better had she chosen a legal way of dealing with this alleged abuse. I mean, I'll get people in my office that are dealing with abuse. Now, I can guarantee you, Chuck, that I don't suggest they go out and kill the abuser. There are ways that you deal with it without doing something like this. There are authorities. There are leave, separate. The bottom line is, she chose to do something that will affect those kids forever, and now our society, or at least this judge, is acting as though this ought not to be a concern. The fact that she's the one who did this, that destroyed the family by killing her husband, and now she gets to raise the kids.
Well, you know, we can talk ourselves out of just about anything, and we can talk ourselves into just moving on to whatever's next, but this outcome seems to me to create an irrevocable situation where this woman should never be in charge of her children again, whether she was abused or what. Even as I say that, I'm thinking there are probably people listening to you and me saying, "Oh, Chuck, don't be such a jerk. You know, don't be such a hard-hearted individual.
Well,
let the woman raise her children and pray for the best and be done with it."
Well, and that's there. I hear that. I think it's not as though she would have to cease to be a part of these kids' lives. But you and I know how it is, Chuck. We're both raising kids. They see what we do. They see how we are. I don't know if there's anything more educational to children than just by watching their mom and dad. Not necessarily listening to them, but by watching them. And I think it's going to be more important for kids in a circumstance like this to have people in their lives raising them who do so without having killed someone. Again, it's almost crazy that we would have to sit there and defend that point of view.
505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. Charles wants to come on into the program. Hi, Charles. You're in the Bible study.
Yeah. Hello there, gentlemen. Chuck, you had mentioned something earlier. You were on another subject. Can I revert back to the subject earlier?
You certainly
earlier?
Can.
I just got on in the tail end of it. You were talking about something, I think a discovery of water on Mars and something else. I'm not certain. Is that correct
well,
or not?
What we were saying was that in modern American scientists' pursuit of the ever-blessed molecule of water, which will justify all of their evolutionary perspectives, the news today is that they have discovered a chemical substance in the soil of Mars which would tend to make it more difficult for life to be present than easier for life to be present. So it was something of a setback.
I'm not surprised. Anyhow, you made an interesting statement. You said that when they finally discovered water, it just seemed like the scientists, the evolutionary scientists, jumped with glee at the realization that the answer was there for the jumping on the bandwagon, bingo, the underlying hypothesis that life was there. But I just wanted to just underline what you said, the implications of the ridiculousness of this. There's an organization here in St. Louis called Missouri Association for Creation. We meet every second Monday at a church here in Chesterfield, or near Chesterfield. Anyhow, have speakers, and this one speaker, an excellent speaker, had his whole speech underlying the two words, necessary and sufficient. And what an incredible talk it was. And he said, in essence, that, yes, water is necessary for life, but water is not sufficient. In fact, water is necessary for life, carbon is necessary for life, atmosphere and oxygen is necessary for life, but just because there's something that's there that's necessary, it doesn't automatically prove the sufficiency of everything that's necessary for life to happen. In fact, trillions and trillions of other factors must occur with incredible design and all that.
And that's so obvious, you wonder why anybody would have to even have a seminar to say it.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
You do.
Exactly.
Hey, okay.
But I just wanted to underline what you said.
Thank you, sir. Mark. Any comments, Kurt?
Yeah, there was we had a guest speaker out here, too, that's a scientist, and he kept using the term irreducible complexity. Have you heard that term,
yeah,
Chuck?
I don't know what it means, but I've heard it.
Well, it means that when you get even the simplest of organisms, and again, the hypothesis being that things can happen by accident, that life can generate by accident or spontaneously. The idea behind irreducible complexity is that there are too many things that have to be happening at the same time in even the simplest kind of life for there ever to have been an accidental generation of that life. One time I was attending a lecture and they were talking about this particular beetle that shoots out, I don't know, flame or smoke or something like that. And
that would have been John Lennon, I think.
good. If I had a drum set here, Chuck.
But I apologize.
But that you take this apart, and there are all of these processes that have to be happening at exactly the same time for that beetle not to be blown up by its own, you know, emissions. And to say that something like that could just develop when, all right, the first beetle that might be able to do it gets blown up because not everything is there together, well, that's the end of it now. It's all over with. No, instead, what they say is that by accident, thousands of things were able to happen at exactly the same time for this beetle to do what it does. And I think this idea of irreducible complexity is a good scientific approach to this whole question of evolution, that some things are far too complicated and so many things have to be happening at the same time for it to have accidentally developed.
You know what? I think God sits on his throne on a daily basis and watches what's going on down here and blesses us with the ability to do this scientific exploration. And every day we learn something new about this complexity, and he thinks, now they will see that it comes from me.
Yeah.
And somehow, some way, we're able to say, this is proof that life evolved. It's just, I think it's just amazing.
I have a member of mine who's about to go into college to be a scientist, and I told her how proud I was that she was going to do that and how glad I was that we were going to have someone who understands the real science of creationism that's going to be in that field. And she says, you know what, though? She has observed that more and more and more scientists are beginning to at least acknowledge the idea of intelligent design. They're not ready to say God yet, but it's a step, at least as she has observed, it is a step toward the recognition that this could not have been accidental. And she says that it's growing in the scientific community, and I think that's a good thing.
Let's take another call here, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Hi, James, you're on the Bible study.
Yes, Pastor, could you take a quick look at Proverbs 10, verse 25, 11, verse 3, and 11, verse 6?
Wait, Proverbs 10, 25.
Yes.
When the storm has swept by, the wicked are gone, but the righteous stand firm forever.
Yes, and 11, verse 3.
The integrity of the upright guides them, but the unfaithful are destroyed by their duplicity.
And 11, verse 6.
The righteousness of the upright delivers them, but the unfaithful are trapped by evil desires.
Now, what I'd like to ask you, Pastor, is this righteousness and integrity, imputed or intrinsic to Christian character?
It is imputed. We are righteous because of Christ's righteousness. This is not inherent in us. We're born entirely apart from God without any righteousness of our own. So what happens is that God comes to us and gives to us the righteousness of Christ. You know, one of the things that I have been pleasantly reminded of these last few years is that imputed righteousness aspect of our salvation. Here's what that means. We're used to acknowledging the forensic aspects of our righteousness, which means God declares us not guilty of sin. Therefore, everything that we've done wrong, God has now forgiven. I think, even as I would be preaching, I have fallen short of emphasizing the other part of that, the imputed righteousness, namely that the perfect life of obedience that Jesus lived now becomes our righteousness, so that God sees us as having the righteousness of Christ because we have faith. One of the illustrations that I think is helpful for this is a good computer illustration where if you take, and even though now it's becoming outdated, if you take a floppy drive and a floppy disk, and you got two of them, one of them says Christ and one of them says us or our name. You put in Christ's disk onto the computer and you upload all of that righteousness onto the hard drive. Then you pull out the disk. Then you put in our disk and you upload all of the sin that is ours onto that hard drive. Now you put in Christ's disk again. You download all of our sin and all of our guilt onto him. Take that out. And you put our disk back in and you download all of that righteousness of Christ onto us. That's the imputed righteousness that comes through faith in Christ, who has lived a perfect life and now gives that to us so that we are righteous.
And it takes a larger being to execute that transfer.
Absolutely. That transfer comes from God himself, who has declared that the work of Jesus is good enough. And he declared that at Jesus' resurrection. When he raised Jesus from the dead, that was the statement to the world that what Jesus has done is good enough for people to be forgiven of their sins and have righteousness. So that then, when God comes to us in our baptism, or for some people when God comes through the Word, the spoken Word, and they come to faith, it's like all of that righteousness of Christ gets poured into us. I think that's a great image of baptism as well. Once again, we're usually thinking of the very biblical imagery of how the washing with baptism cleanses us from all of our sin. Certainly, the Bible speaks exactly that way. But elsewhere in the Bible, it talks about being clothed with Christ. In other words, in baptism, we're getting wet. Something is becoming part of us now that wasn't there before, namely the righteousness of Christ. So that action of pouring water is not just an action of washing away what's bad, but replacing it with what's good, the righteousness of Christ, which then is how we are regenerated, to serve God, to love others, and so on.
Well spoken by a guy who is even now downloading Brett Favre into the Green Bay Packers. Let's see if we can squeeze one more telephone call in here and talk with Jim. Hi, you're on the Bible study. Jim, you there? Jim may have not been willing to wait. All right, we got a couple of minutes here. It gives me an opportunity to ask you about this, and I guess I'll just have to speed this up. There's a story on Times Online today, the puppies of a hero pit bull, whose name, unfortunately for us radio people, is Booger. are the world's first commercial clones.
Oh, yes.
South Korea has carried out the first commercial cloning of a pet dog, creating 5 identical copies of Booger, the pit bull terrier, for an American client. Bernan McKinney, 57 years old, blinked back tears of joy as she cuddled her 5 puppy clones, created at Seoul National University's veterinary school using some of Booger's refrigerated ear tissue. Here's what she says. "This is a miracle. These guys gave me the best present," Ms. McKinney told a press conference in Seoul. She claimed that her late pet, a rescue dog whom she found by the side of the road, saved her life by chasing off a ferocious mastiff 3 times her size, which had caused her appalling injuries. The mastiff, another of her pets, and had been driven mad by being given 10 times the recommended dose of medication for a bee sting. So what she's done is she's regained not just Booger, but the same dog 5 times over.
Mm-hmm.
We have 2 minutes. Somebody somewhere is going to come to the conclusion that if you can just get a little ear DNA, I can be back.
Yeah. You know, I think obviously this is something that you and Dr. Wise or whoever could spend all day on. Here's what concerns me. It's not the technology that concerns me. I think this is great that we're able to do this sort of thing. I think it's great that because we've done research and so on, we've found different ways to improve people's lives. What concerns me is I don't know that we have the values and the morality to control what we're able to do.
Well, I can answer that for you, Pastor.
Well, and that's the problem. I don't think...
We're studying Jeremiah. I can answer that for you.
Yeah, and that's the point. And that's where it needs to come down to. Not can we do this, but should we do this? And not because it may be bad, but because are we morally and theologically responsible enough to do this in a way that will be God-pleasing and people-helping? And if we answer that question no, then I don't think we should be doing this.
Well, the answer to that question is no,
yeah.
And we will be doing it.
And this is where the church, you know, needs to have a voice and continue sounding the bell of warning.
You know how much money this woman paid for this?
No, how much?
$50,000.
Wow. Yeah, we'll be seeing more of it, Chuck.
We're going to be seeing more of it. You know, I wonder, you know, I'll leave you with this thought. Do you have a pet at your house?
No.
I used to
when I was a kid, though.
All right. Well, let's say that, you know, you have a dog.
Yep.
A dog can live 14 years, let's say. So you're 3 years old when you get your dog. You're 17 years old when that dog passes away. So now you get that dog cloned before she passes away, and now you have the same dog for another 14 years.
Mm-hmm.
Can you deal with that?
I'm telling you.
I mean...
We're going to have to answer... And those questions are difficult, but I don't know that we are responsible enough to be dealing with this yet.
Thank you, Pastor.
Thank you, Chuck.
Pastor Kurt Taylor with us here on our Ask the Pastor Bible study. Thank you for the phone calls. Appreciate that. We will continue in Jeremiah tomorrow. Pastor Tim Ostermeyer, Jeremiah 44.
For the Bible study to continue, our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the Internet at kfuo.org. For a free copy of the Bible study, please visit the audio archive section of our homepage. That's kfuo.org. The Bible study is a broadcast service of Worldwide KFUO.